This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville Tomorrow joins us, and we'll continue our discussion from the last half hour, and we're also going to talk growth and development. And at any time, if you have the urge to join this very conversation, you pick up your phone, 977-1070, a local call, a local conversation about our lovely burg. Brian, you wanted to say a few more words about the county budget.
I can't talk enough about the budget. Well, I think, you know, thinking about Charlottesville Tomorrow's coverage of the supervisors and this community discussion that we're having on the budget, I think there are some important issues. One of the things that I think the county Republicans have been helpful at bringing to the surface with some of their communications is that need for long-range planning by the local government when it comes to budgeting. And I think it's important to note that in November, the Board of Supervisors received the projected assessment information. So this was not a surprise that suddenly, you know, appeared in January when everyone got their assessments in their mailbox. This was something they should have seen coming. And I guess the thing I would suggest, and I've talked about this on Charlottesville Tomorrow's blog under our budget coverage, is that local government really needs to be having this conversation in November. I mean, if we want good governance, if we want our professionals who have been hired to run local government to have enough time to figure out how to save money or be more efficient, whatever that goal is, let's give them specific targets earlier rather than after they've already put their budgets to rest. And I think that's a conversation that the whole community would benefit from.
So instead of putting a budget together and then having public hearings on that budget and tweaking it, have the public hearings before they do a budget.
Well, you could certainly do that. I think the important thing, for example, the school board and board of supervisors sit down every October, November and talk compensation strategy. We have a competitive market. The Board of Supervisors looks at that and says, okay, how's our market doing? What target are we going to set for salaries? And then that decision is sort of made. You may remember there was a discussion about living wage. That started last October, November. And I think if you broaden that to the whole county budget or the whole school budget and say, here's what we think is an appropriate rate of growth. Here's an appropriate starting place. However you want to frame that, I think that's the time to have that conversation. Right now, it strikes me as an observer of this as throwing darts at a dartboard to try to find the right tax rate. And I think that just makes for poor decisions. You know, there's not enough time in between these work sessions. For example, a week ago, the supervisors were throwing out what tax rate they thought was appropriate. So the numbers range from 68. Three members said 68 cents. One member said 71, one member said 72, and one said 74 or higher. And then within a few days, that changed such that one of those at 68 said, well, I think I'll be at 70 now. And so now yesterday, you know, I'm covering a work session of the Board of Supervisors, and all of the staff information being projected up on the screen says, well, here's what we would have to do at 70 cents. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how did they pick 70? So I went up and asked the staff members afterwards, and they said, well, Mr. Dorier, you know, shifted his position, so we figure that's sort of the least common denominator that is likely to get support.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just strikes me as wrong that we go about things like this. So I agree with a lot of the members of the public that I've heard recently, the past couple of weeks, expressing concerns about how we do a budget. And I think we can do it better.
Brian, hasn't there been some discussion to provide some type of metric so that we don't play this little game every couple of years and throw these darts and try to pick a number out of the air? I know the Republicans have discussed this idea of let's really sit down and come up with some metrics and a way of deciding this number.
That's right. They've talked about you know, looking at student enrollment, looking at population growth, looking at cost of living, inflation. Those are certainly good metrics. We also have to factor in the cost of revenue sharing, the increases based on those assessments that leads to a 30% increase that we have to send money to the city of Charlottesville. We have to look at the cost of the state not funding things less. Now, secondary roads is something you and I have talked about a lot. That money is declining in real dollars over time. So the state is putting in less money each year that we can use to build roads. The Board of Supervisors has been looking at setting aside $2 million a year to fund roads. That's a decision we have to make as a community. Do we want to, you know, sort of let the state off the hook and say, okay, you're not going to do it, we'll take care of it. But that has consequences for our local property taxes. If somebody could figure out the way to take all those different unfunded mandates and declining this from the state and declining that from the feds and put it into a recipe, I think that'd be great. It's a very difficult proposition. I get uncomfortable when, as a taxpayer sitting there, when the CEO of the county comes in and says, here's how we plan to spend the new revenues. And that's really how these budget discussions are framed, because as assessments go up, unless there's a direction to lower the tax rate, there is new money available. And so the plan then is, okay, I make the assumption that we have smart people who are assessing programs and personnel and things that are being done today and determining which ones should be moved over to the next year. But there's still, you know, going to be money and new initiatives that are going to be talked about. So that's a long-winded answer of saying, yes, I think we should have some of those metrics looked at. We should also be looking at the five-year plans for the county. And the supervisors have done that. They've got five-year projections. They don't look good when you factor in the initiatives and the strategic plan that they wanted to do.
When you don't look good in what way? Enough revenue?
They go negative quickly based on today's tax rate of 74 cents. So if late last year and in January of this year, the supervisors got information saying, if you want to do the strategic initiatives you've talked about, whether it's, you know, moving more quickly on some of these road projects, building libraries where we want them, doing the fire rescue, building out our master planned communities like Crozet, the board has been shown in meeting after meeting, you know, here's how we fund our vision, guys. We may have to borrow more money. We may have to do a general revenue bond and ask the voters in a referendum if they support that. All of those things are now off the table. That all the new initiatives and strategic funding that they were going to do over the next 5 years, that the staff have now taken that off the table, saying at 70 cents, we can't do that. So it's,
but they still have more money coming in than they did the year before.
They do. And again, there are added costs in
sure. The cost of things goes up. Just as we all know, you write a check, you know, the stuffs are more expensive this year than it was last year. Yep. And that's true for government as well. But you would think it's not going up that much. I mean,
well, what, you know, it adds a lot of cost to build a new fire station and staff it. When you get into personnel on the school division, when you have an increasing number of English as a second language students, that takes personnel. When we have to build new schools, that takes, you know, money that we borrow and pay for those capital
and
projects.
And the personnel is really what's expensive, because you're talking about people going on the payroll and benefits, and they're not going to be gone.
That's right.
Tomorrow, they're still staying around.
And we have an aging workforce. And, you know, when you take the teachers, there are 1,000-plus teachers in the school division. And as they move up the ladder in compensation, and the baby boomers are approaching retirement, we've got this sort of, big wave of people at the high end of our salary scale. So it's a problem in multiple ways. Those people are all going to retire soon. And Albemarle County is going to want to be competitive and be able to attract those people, and same for the city of Charlottesville. But also, they're expensive employees right now.
We're talking with Brian Wheeler, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. Linda is on the line in Albemarle County. Linda, thank you so much for the call. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I was unable to turn on the radio before now, so I don't know if you've addressed this, and forgive me if I'm repeating something, but I was at the meeting last night. And I recall very strongly that the discussion was not whether it was 74 cents or 70 cents, but based on the law that was cited, it's supposed to have been 58 cents on the dollar. And I haven't heard you say anything about that. Maybe you said it earlier, but...
Yeah, we did talk about it in the last half hour, and thank you so much for the call. But just to reiterate, if I understand it, the law says if the board doesn't change the rate themselves, it would automatically go to 58 cents unless they change it themselves, and every board always does. whether they lower it or raise it. Is
correct.
That right?
Correct. The Board of Supervisors, and Linda, thanks for the call. We did talk about this, and the board will have to advertise an effective rate of keeping government basically level funded. It's 1% growth. That will have to be in the advertisement. The city of Charlottesville has already advertised that rate, and I don't remember it off the top of my head. But Gary O'Connell in the city came in and said, I'm recommending we keep the rate at 99 cents, the current rate. So that certainly reflects a tax increase. And I think the spirit of the discussion last night was, where's the starting place for this conversation? Last night, we heard a lot of speakers talk about, let's have the starting place be 58 cents and then figure out how to build up from there. What I see a lot of in the budget meetings is the starting place is available revenues and whatever the current tax rate is. And do you go up or down from there? So it's sort of, it comes down to the philosophy of how you build a budget. And I think that's the important community discussion. I think some valuable feedback has come out of this.
Right. The other point that was kind of appalling, and I'd never heard of this before, was that new line item of $905,000, almost $1 million for external and internal PR.
Yes, Linda, we actually discussed that at length in the last half hour, and we will have that podcast at charlottesvillepodcast.com, and Brian responded to that at length. Susan is on the line in Albemarle County. Susan, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Coy. I think one of the things that Brian Wheeler is saying that people really need to listen to, and he's exactly right, is that if the state and the federal government are telling us what we need to do, then that's where we need to start asking for that money to come down. And I like the term he used, I believe, was mandate. And I am a firm believer that we need to fund our schools and we need to fund our projects and our community. But we're being kind of tied by the hands. And I think it was Mr. Rooker, I'm not sure, at one of the public hearings that said we could have applied for a waiver that would have helped bring funds in and our legislators wouldn't support that. And I just was wondering, and maybe you've addressed it, I don't know, if Mr. Wheeler could possibly speak to that.
That's a great question. The what the caller is referring to is there's certain localities in Virginia that are considered high cost of living localities, and they have a special setup with the General Assembly and the funding of education that allows them to get more for their education dollar. They get when the state gives a 4% raise for teachers, these localities get more resources to help make that happen because those localities they recognize have a high cost of living. Charlottesville and Albemarle are not included on that list. But recently, according to Mr. Rooker and some of the school board members that presented this information to him, other localities like I think it was Winchester and Culpeper were recently added. The school board and the Board of Supervisors meet with the local General Assembly delegation and give them sort of a wish list. You know, heading into this next session, here are the things we would like to see. One of those items was, please get us added to that list. Get Charlottesville and Albemarle put on that list of high cost of living localities. Because clearly, we are second to Northern Virginia, one of the highest cost of living places in the state. And right now, we're not on that list. And one of the concerns I think I heard voiced by one of the delegates was the problem he saw of creating sort of an island that was on that list and then surrounding localities he represented that were not. And whereas all these other localities on the list are sort of contiguous to each other and have sort of been working their way southward from Northern Virginia and down the 95 corridor, Mr. Rooker made the point that I think that was $3 million in additional money that the state would have been contributing to us had we been on that list. So that's a good example. You know, the 4% when the governor passes a budget, that only covers some of our teachers in Albemarle County.
Why would Winchester be on a list for a high cost of living and we're not? I mean, Winchester.
I hope I'm right mentioning Winchester. I think that was one of the localities mentioned.
Brian Wheeler is my guest this afternoon, and the phone lines are open at 977-1070. We are roaming the landscape of Albemarle County budget assessments, school board policies, and I do want to just say again, Linda asked about the line item in the school board budget that was referred to at last night's meeting. Brian Wheeler, of the at-large member of the county school board, discussed this at length in the last hour on this program, and that will be podcast on the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Do you want to just add to that really quick? Okay. The phone lines are open at 977-1070. Where should we go now? Where should we go?
Well, let's see. Why don't we... How many minutes do we have?
We've got about... one, two, three, four... We've got about 3 or 4 minutes before we're going to break for local news.
Okay, let me just run through a couple calendar items. This will fill up this time because there's some important meetings coming up. This is probably a good time to catch people while they're listening. Very interesting work session going on today at the county office building. I'm recording it right now on green building. The county is looking at ways to make its new public facilities green, environmentally green, sustainable, environmentally friendly, and they're pursuing what's called the LEED certification for these buildings. There's a work session on that. We will put the audio up on our website. That'll be the only place you can get it, and if you're interested in green building and approaches the county's taking, you can tune into that.
Let me ask you this really quick about that, because I'm ignorant. It sounds like it's really expensive to do this green stuff. It's not that it's just vogue and it's cool to do this. It really does save money in the long run, ?
Yeah. Well, one of the slides I saw before I came running over here, there are different levels of certification under this environmental certification list called LEED. And at the lowest end, it was like 0.66% increase in cost. At the high end, a platinum LEED certified building, it was I want to say 6% more expensive. One of the things that the staff who investigated this told the Board of Supervisors was they should expect to add about 2% in building cost. And again, that's upfront cost. Then you hope to recover that down the road in energy savings and other things
hope
like that.
Hope to. I would hope that you would definitely would do if you're going to raise costs to build a building. I hope that would definitely know that they were going to save money.
And that's one of the things the supervisors ask for. You know, show us on paper what's the return on investment for making these kinds of decisions.
Otherwise, we'll just build the buildings like we've always built them.
Right. Well, I think there's a pretty good track record on this front of what the certification would deliver. And the important point I think staff were trying to make to the Board of Supervisors was you need to start early in the design process. You can't, you know, be halfway through the design of a building and then say, oh, we want to make it green. You need to start from the beginning and ground up, build it that way.
And for folks who don't know, making it green means what exactly?
Well, it could be everything from the materials you use, the orientation of the building on the site, you know, towards the sun, having a green roof, you know, actually growing grass and other plants on the roof to absorb moisture. That also helps hold in, you know, cool air when you're cooling the building and helps keep it warm in the winter as well. So different steps like that.
We're talking with Brian Wheeler of Charlottesville Tomorrow, online at sevilletomorrow.org. Brian, you saw the article in the Seville Weekly this week called Let's Make a Deal by Jason Whitehead. Arguably some of the best investigative reporting that I have seen in local media in years. Really a terrific article. And we don't want to steal his thunder because we want to get him on the program to talk about it. But what was tell folks what it's about and your thoughts on it as a local expert on growth and development.
I would echo those sentiments, Corey. I think it was an excellent piece. So kudos to Jason. The Seville, you know, basically did a in-depth study of what happened with a land swap that took place between Wendell Wood, a developer a lot of people know who's done a lot of projects up 29 North, Hollymead Town Center being one of them, and also the area around the National Ground Intelligence Center. And basically, the Ground Intelligence Center needed room to expand. One of the pieces of property Wendell owned was one they were interested in, but the federal government only had so much money to spend on that, and it wasn't enough to make it worth Wendell's while from his point of view. So he was looking to get a better return on investment on that piece of property. At the same time, the County Board of Supervisors was interested in doing what was possible to help this employment center expand. So there was another property owner that apparently Ken Boyd was in touch with, Clarabelle Wheeler, no relation, who had some land up 20 North that was in the Pantops growth area that she wanted to have put back into the rural area. So the swap that came about was if Clarabelle Wheeler's land could be moved back to rural, and sort of they could then replace that by taking some of Wendell's land that was in the rural area, make a development area, then that would be, there'd be some economic upside for Mr. Wood to have land moved into the development area, he can develop it more intensely.
And make more money off of that land.
Make more money off of that because he...
To compensate for the fact that he couldn't make a lot as much as he wanted selling to the government so that Injit could expand.
So that's sort of it in a nutshell.
And this is all legal.
Yeah. Yeah, they passed a resolution of intent. I mean, I think if you talk to different members, and certainly Jason did in his article, some of them wish they had had more time to review all the different permutations of this and really try to figure out how realistic the threat was that NGIC might move to another locality. I think that was one of the things one of the supervisors was saying, was they sort of felt backed into a corner being told that...
bullied, you know, I think, was one of the words used in the article.
Yeah, that if they didn't help NGIC expand, you know, Senator Hutchinson from Texas was ready to, you know, pull out the golden shovels and break ground in Texas for the new NGIC facility. I don't have any sense as to how realistic that was because I wasn't in on any of those discussions.
Well, one of the disturbing things about the article was the fact that all of these meetings that took place about this between just two people. Explain this to us, because I that really sort of, as an Albemarle citizen, that sort of ticked me off.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Coy, because in the previous hour, you were sort of saying that you didn't understand why more elected officials weren't at the Republican forum last night.
Yes, I thought they should be there to learn and to hear what folks think.
And one of the issues you run into is public officials can only really appear in twos and conduct public business and not be conducting public business. I'm sorry, I misspoke there. So if you have more than two and public business is going on, you have to advertise it as a public meeting. That's part of the open government law in Virginia that I think we're pretty proud of, that we have a very good tradition of freedom of information.
So all the supervisors couldn't go to that meeting last night without calling it a public meeting.
Correct. Now, they could have called a special meeting and been there and participated and been up on the stage and responded to questions. The line you sort of run into is if more than two members are participating, then it really needs to be advertised as a public meeting.
But they can go and just sit in the audience, right?
They can.
And that's what they could have done last night.
They can. There is some level of discomfort on occasion because you are always told by, the attorneys representing the school board and the board of supervisors, be very careful in these situations. You know, don't make it appear like, you know, don't sit together and make it appear to be a public meeting where you're all sitting there gathering information and then responding to questions because then you're sort of crossing that line. So it's funny when you get elected and you start serving this capacity. You start getting all these warnings about open government. You know, hang on to all your emails. All those are discoverable documents for Freedom of Information Act request. And if you run into another board member and a third board member shows up, you know, disperse immediately.
run away.
So there are all these warnings, and that I think, you know, unfortunately is sort of a counterbalance and prevents people sometimes from showing up at these events.
All that said, They should have been there last night.
Okay.
So they still should have been there last night. They didn't have to sit together, they didn't have to say a word.
You're right.
But you had almost a full auditorium at the county office building of local citizens who wanted to speak out and be heard about assessments.
I was wearing my Charlottesville Tomorrow hat, but there was another school board member present, and Mr. Ken Boyd was also present representing the supervisor. But back to Wendell Wood, I think what you were suggesting is that is it right for supervisors to be sort of pulled off in twos and met with and talked about things?
But they were doing it very consciously to avoid having to have a public meeting.
That's right. And advocates on the other side of any issue will do the exact same thing. And I think Sally Thomas made that point in the article. What it requires is discipline by the elected officials to make sure they don't cross the line, but certainly meeting in twos, in pairs, and talking with the public or talking with a developer or talking with, you know, anybody is perfectly legal. But
in this case, they look like they were doing it specifically to make this deal happen for Wendell Wood / Injic. They didn't have secret meetings or meetings only with people who might have opposed this.
Well, that's, you know, the had...
And if they did, it's certainly not in the article. We're not aware of it.
You know, what I think some supervisors would say would be, had there been more time to advertise this as an agenda item at a public meeting, then anyone who had a concern about this issue would then have had time, if they wanted to pull supervisors in ones or twos and meet with them, then they could have gotten their opinion on the table. I think you're absolutely right to point that out. Given the time frame, it sounds like, of when this decision was had to be made, whether you call that bullying or limited time frame to make a decision based on federal government commitment to this project, you know, it sort of depends who's interpreting what happened.
We're talking with Brian Reeler, the executive director of Charlottesville Tomorrow, online at cvilletomorrow.org. All the podcasts of important local meetings, you can listen to them right there. And the phone lines are open at 977-1070. I just want to say this one photograph that's in the article in the Seville Weekly this week of Wendell Wood back in 97 signing the deal, the land deal that sold the original land to Engic. I took that picture.
It looks crooked, Coy.
I took all my pictures crooked back then. That was a part of the signature flair. I remember being at that meeting, and I even made all the lawyers and Wendell Wood stand up and hold up his check. But it was $1 million. It was $1 million for all that land that Engic is on now.
Right.
And the additional land now is worth, he's saying, like $16 million. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That in just 10 years, that land has gone up that much.
Well, it's, you know, and of course, we were talking about the tax rate and as property assessments, and land is going up tremendously. You know, back to the open government issue, I mean, it's something we've also talked about with the City Planning Commission. And I think there you heard members of the City Planning Commission say they were uncomfortable being pulled off in those ones and twos by developers and being asked to, you know, talk about. So there are different points of view on this. And I think the important thing is that the media pays attention to things like this, that we get things on agendas for public comment, and that as much as possible, the information is put out there for people to react to on both sides. And that's what the public really wants, to know that they've had an opportunity, they know it's on the agenda, and then we can see what the decision makers do.
Hear, hear. That all sounds good. Speaking of Charlottesville, the big news today, of course, there's the downtown parking garages and a parking lot are up for sale. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I think they've been trying to sell them for, you know, over a year. I think Waldo at Seville News had this on his blog sometime last year when he was talking about this.
Yeah. And Brian McNeil has it in the Progress yesterday.
And so one deal fell through last year. Looks like now they're ready to move again. And they're talking about how they want to return some value to the investors who apparently invested in this decades and decades ago and haven't seen any return to speak of. So that's kind of interesting. I think the more interesting story is what's going to happen next, not necessarily to the parking garage and ownership, but to the open parking lots that have not been developed. And there,
and this is between Water Street and South Street, south of the downtown
mall.
That's
right, right in front of the new Live Arts building down there, that big open lot. And that open lot, the first one, is owned by Charlottesville Parking Center, the people that own the garage. But then you get up to where the city market is held, and you've got the metered lot that's owned by the city of Charlottesville.
The one that won't take dimes and nickels.
Yeah, they're the quarters now. You know, I remember when it took all three coins.
Yeah, they changed it. Now it only takes quarters.
And I remember
and
when
that's
it was like,
ridiculous.
I remember it was like a quarter for 10 hours or something.
Oh, really?
Anyway, there are three lots in that little complex, two privately held, one owned by the city. And I was involved in an effort by some community members to ask city council to have a design competition for those sites. The thinking being, you know, something is, we know the property owner of the big one wants to sell it. So instead of just letting that happen and then having the developer come to the city and say, hey, we'd really like to combine both sites and build one big thing, whatever that thing is.
Yeah.
Let's be forward thinking about this. Let's look at the comprehensive plan. Let's look at the community's priorities. Let's think about how, you know, the downtown mall might be connected that direction.
Yeah,
towards
that was,
South Street,
right,
towards
right.
ACAC.
I can remember walking down
the
there.
Building.
I remember walking across that parking garage. This is 10 plus years ago with Hooja, former director of development for the city. And he was saying, oh, I got this dream of running the downtown mall south across Water Street, all the way to South Street, all the way down to the old...
the Frank Hicks building.
Yeah, well, what's the thing that it runs dead ends into? The old hardware...
Gleason?
Yes, thank you.
The Gleason's building.
Running it all the way down to the Gleason's area. And he said, you know, it would be beautiful and have buildings on each side and continue this pedestrian thing across Water Street, across South Street, over the railroad tracks. It would be gorgeous.
Well, and at the end of last year, City Council put a little money into that to have a design competition. That was actually a story we broke on Charlottesville Tomorrow's blog. And I talked to the Charlottesville Community Design Center today. They're the ones that won the contract to facilitate this design competition, but it would be what's called an ideas competition. And it would encompass all three of those sites, even though the city doesn't own them all, just to get some ideas on the table of here's how we could develop it, achieve the community's goals, look at the things that the community wants that are missing, you know, whether that's parks or whether it's underground parking, whatever that priority list is. These designs would come in, and it would be a judged contest. There would be a winner, but it's an ideas competition. The winner wouldn't necessarily be the winning design. There's private property involved, but it would help, I think, expand people's vision about what's possible.
Yeah, and this is something architects do all the time, and certainly with the A School here at the University of Virginia, this kind of thing is done quite frequently where you invite architecture students to participate. I remember years ago they did this with the Fry Spring area. Fifeville. They did it with Fifeville, and there were a number of contributions from mm-hmm. students about, hey, this is what Fifeville could look like. It looks the same today, a decade later, not much going on.
Well, the Charlottesville Community Design Center has done two other competitions in the community, and they're sort of building on that success. They did the Sunrise Trailer Park, which Habitat for Humanity is involved with, and they took this trailer park and tried to figure out, they held a design competition to figure out how to build better housing that would keep the current residents in place and allow them to have a better community. So that now Habitat has hired the first place and second place teams from that competition to take it to the next level. Belvedere Farms is a development in the county up Rio, and that's going to be a big mixed-use, walkable, livable community following the county's neighborhood model. And the Community Design Center worked on a part of that to sort of have a contest about how to build the town center. So this is something that has worked well in our community. It's gotten good ideas on the table. And here we have an opportunity, both with the interest of the property owners to sell it, but also support from City Council to have a competition to really do something out of the box and that will really advance the goals of downtown Charlottesville.
Brian, you think the city's going to buy that parking garage?
I don't really have any idea.
You think they should? Because there's some debate now. There's some on the council saying, hey, we should buy that parking garage, use public money to help keep parking inexpensive downtown. And then there's, you know, people, Kevin Lynch comes to mind, who's saying, we don't have any business getting in the private market like that. We shouldn't be buying that parking garage.
Yeah. You know, I only have a personal opinion on that, and I'd sort of agree with Mr. Lynch that let the private sector do its thing and let the market control, you know,
the cost parking of parking prices. Downtown.
But I think whatever comes next in that site, if there are uses there that require cars, we need to be thinking about, you know, underground,
where they're going to go.
Underground parking.
Yeah.
But also we need to think about, you know, again, transit and alternatives to getting in our cars. And potentially something there could be something that we want to make sure fits in with goals about streetcars or bus rapid transit and things like that. And just make sure this is the last undeveloped part of downtown Charlottesville. So let's do it right. You know, let's make sure that it accommodates those things and that we have a better product.
Am I the only one? And I have all the respect in the world for the folks who own those train tracks and those big companies that run those empty coal cars through our neighborhoods west to get more coal and then take them back down to the ports and export coal to South America and China.
Is that where they go?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
But here's my question is, am I the only ones that think it's ridiculous that we have all these tracks running through and we don't use them? Like, the tracks run right out near my house in Ivy, but I can't get on those tracks and go downtown. I have
so
to get
want,
in a car.
You want commuter rail.
I think it would be wonderful. Yeah. Wouldn't it be great to be able to get on a little metro in Crozet and zip right downtown or zip up to the airport?
Absolutely. But that's a big ticket item. And I think that all the people that I know that have looked at that well, except for one, all but one of the people I've talked to have said that that is too expensive for us to really pursue, given the density, given the number, the population we have here. You're right. We do have this sort of, you know, grid on the compass of railroad tracks going east, west, north, south, and you would think.
But CNO would, Norfolk, they wouldn't let us use those tracks.
Well, I think it's complicated by that, by sharing the tracks. It's also just expensive for the equipment you'd have to buy and maintain.
Yeah.
What the transportation activists in the community are most excited about right now is in the county, the Places 29 master plan, looking at bus rapid transit solutions up and down the 29 North corridor and having that connect up to things in the city, whether it's streetcar, and the streetcar might be expanded. John Faltz is a Republican in the city. He talks a lot in front of city council about how the streetcar would be a great solution and better expanded to places like Biscuit Run, to places like the UVA Fontaine Research Park. And, it, you know, instead of doing a little short one up and down West Main Street, let's take it further. And there's something to be said about putting the rails in the street because it gives that sense of permanence. And then developers know that they can build around those tracks and those stations and that public transit will be there and be available and make that a more attractive place for people to live, work, and shop.
Brian Wheeler is the executive director of Charlottesville Tomorrow. That's online at SeavilleTomorrow.org. Check out the blog. Check out the podcast. It's all there at SeavilleTomorrow.org. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.